From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Natalia Robert. She's a reporter, anchor, and editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. Our guest on this edition of the program is David Satter, longtime observer of Russia and the former Soviet Union, and author of the recently published book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. David is also a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And he's also a fellow of the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. A native of Chicago, David Satter previously worked as a Moscow correspondent for the London Financial Times. In December 2013, he became the first American journalist to be expelled from Russia since the Cold War. Satter had the audacity to write that the apartment bombings in 1999, which were blamed on Chechens, were actually carried out by the Russian FSB security police. David Satter argues that the bombings were used as a pretext for a new war in Chechnya, and success in fighting this war brought Vladimir Putin to power. In his new book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, David Satter tells this story, as well as how Putin's predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, presided over the criminalization of Russia. Satter also explains why Putin was chosen as Yeltsin's successor and how he suppressed all opposition while simultaneously giving the impression of presiding over a pluralist state. We'll talk with David about his new book, as well as discuss how Vladimir Putin's Russia has insinuated itself in the U.S. presidential election through the alleged cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee's servers and Republican nominee Donald Trump's call for Moscow to hack his opponent Hillary Clinton's emails, among many other controversial statements about NATO, Crimea, and Ukraine. David Satter joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be with you.
We're delighted to have you back again, and I'm delighted to welcome my colleague Natalia Robert from the Ukrainian service. Well, David, first to your book. The title alone, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, quite disturbing and telling, and it seems to be a watchword for Putin's Russia. Now, you say that the FSB, Russian security forces, were in fact responsible for the apartment bombings back in 1999, and that as a result of this act of terror against his own people, Putin rules today. That is quite an assertion. How did you reach that conclusion?
Well, it was not difficult to reach that conclusion because FSB agents were arrested putting a bomb in a building that was not blown up in the city of Ryazan, southeast of Moscow. They were caught planting the bomb. The bomb was tested positive for hexagon, the high explosive that was used in the four preceding bombs. And the head of director of the FSB went on national television to say that this was actually a test of vigilance, that it was only a training exercise, and that the bomb consisted of nothing but sugar. Well, the test didn't show sugar. It showed hexagon, for one thing. The bomb was photographed and date-stamped, and it had a live military detonator. It's possible to believe absolutely anything, but it is really beyond imagination that the Russians could have organized a test of vigilance in a city in Russia at a time when the whole country was terrorized by the bombings that had already taken place. Besides that, the speaker of the State Duma, Gennady Selezniov, made an announcement on September 13th that a building had been blown up in Volgodonsk. Well, the building that was blown up on September 13th was in Moscow on Kashirskaya Chasse. 3 days later, however, the building in Volgodonsk was blown up, raising the question of how did he know 3 days in advance that Volgodonsk was going to be the target of a terrorist attack?
But certainly your narrative is completely denied by
Putin, and the Russian leadership try not to deal with this subject at all. There were some reactions when these charges were made in the Russian press in 1999, 2000. But since then, they've done their best to pretend that this doesn't exist. However, as far as the Russian people are concerned, from my observations, that virtually everyone in Russia is aware that there's something extremely suspicious about those bombings. And many people are fully convinced that this was a provocation carried out to bring Putin to power. Now, among those people, there are very few who are willing to talk about it openly.
Now, before I turn to my colleague, Natalia, let's turn to Yeltsin very quickly, because you said that Russia's road to terror and dictatorship started also under Yeltsin. So let's go back. How was he the root of criminalization of Russia, and how did he then set the stage for Vladimir Putin?
Well, the process of economic change in Russia was carried out without the benefit of the rule of law. Russia was a country, like all of the countries which were once part of the Soviet Union, in which all property was in the hands of the state. A process began for putting that property into private hands. There was a prejudice, and I think it's really nothing more than a prejudice, that if property was in private hands, democracy would result automatically. There was no awareness of the fact that what was, in fact, the largest peaceful transfer of property in human history had to take place within the framework of a rule of law. And as a result, what you got was the criminalization of the country. Yeltsin's closest associates were criminals. He favored criminals. His entourage was completely corrupt. His family was completely corrupt. And he resorted to violence and provocation in order to hold on to power. In 1993, when the Russian parliament was dispersed, and in 1996, when there's ample evidence that the results of the presidential election were falsified. And, of course, in the run-up to the 2000 elections in 1999, when the apartment buildings were bombed. It's important to bear in mind that Putin at that time was not the head of state. It was Yeltsin who was the head of state. And, of course, Putin benefited. But he was not in a position at that point to be the sole author of this act of terror. He had to be one of those who participated in an act of terror, which was conceived, in fact, if not Yeltsin himself, then by members of the Yeltsin entourage. And people often say, well, Yeltsin was drunk, he was comatose, he didn't know what was going on, he was blacking out. And they offer this as an excuse for Yeltsin, who was very popular in the West and who was treated as a legitimate democratic leader by the U.S.
Exactly.
But the reality is a little different. Even if it's true that he was not directly involved in a terrorist act against his own people, and even if it's true that he was dead drunk while all of these things were taking place, first of all, all that meant that it was carried out by his family and entourage, people that he put into power and whom he empowered, and that he was guilty of a gross dereliction of duty. Because as president of the country, it didn't matter if he was dead drunk. He was nonetheless responsible for such a crime.
David, you mentioned that if you ask a large number of Russian people whether they believe or not that the bombings were the provocation, and you say that they do, and yet Putin is regarded and seen in the country as a president who saved the country from Chechens and who resolved the Chechen war. Why is that?
It's a very interesting question. Shortly after Putin became president, the atomic submarine Kursk sank in the Barents Sea, and Putin did not accept offers of foreign help that might have saved dozens of sailors that were trapped in the submarine and running out of air. Some years later, at a ceremony commemorating, I think, 15 years since the Kursk disaster, the children of those who died on the Kursk were interviewed by Russian television. Many of them had T-shirts with pictures of Putin on them, and they were completely devoted to Putin. One of the tragedies of Russia is that the subservience to power is so well developed. It's not out of the question that people would have voted for Putin even if they had known that he was involved in the bombing of those buildings. A correspondent for the British newspaper, The Independent, on the verge of the election, interviewed people in the buildings who lived next to one of those that was blown up on Gurianov Street in Moscow, and asked them who they thought was responsible for the apartment bombing, and they said the FSB. And then he asked them, who are you voting for? And they said Putin. And he said, well, Putin was a former head of the FSB, and you know he was in charge at that time. How can you vote for Putin if you think the government was involved in this act? And they said, well, there's no proof that Putin knew about it. So the spiritual state of the Russian people after centuries of the first czarism, then communism, and then criminal rule under Yeltsin is not conducive to the idea that the individual has himself moral responsibility or that he has the right to hold the government to moral behavior and to moral accountability. This is the problem.
And I think the ratings, the latest ratings in Russia just proves your point. 87% of Russian people who are going through economic hardship right now are still supporting his regime.
But we must bear something in mind about those ratings also, that they could change overnight. They're the product of incessant propaganda on the one hand, the lack of information on the other, a very poor response oftentimes from the West. But more important, they reflect the kind of nationalist psychosis that's been stirred up with the help of the invasions of Ukraine, the intervention in Syria, previously the war in
Georgia.
War is an instrument of internal policy for Russia for precisely this reason, that because of the psychology of the nation, it oftentimes is very, very useful for boosting popularity, at least in the short run. But it's a little bit like a narcotic whose effect will wear off. That's why they're very sensitive about casualties, and they don't want people to know how many people are being killed, for example.
Before we go to a break, just a very quick follow-up, David Satter. So in addition to subservience to power, the sense of nationalism that we see, you also talked about propaganda. So to what extent does President Putin's control of all electronic media, both at home and abroad, reinforce his power and ability to remain popular or at least perpetuate this myth of his?
Oh, it's very important. In fact, that was the reason why, after Putin became president, the first thing he did was to take over the national television networks, which are the principal source of information for Russians.
Well, this is the problem. So how can Russians obtain objective news and information, or are they so brainwashed that whatever other sources there are, perhaps RFERL or even the Voice of America, that they cannot compete with state-controlled media and this patriarchal system?
Oh, it's difficult to compete because, on the one hand, the managers of the Russian media and Russian television are operating on their home turf. They know the psychology of people. They study public opinion very carefully. They know how to manipulate. And they're part of the same society. They themselves have come out of the Soviet Union with its gigantic experiment in mind control and manipulation. So there's plenty of experience in the recent and not so recent past regarding how to do this. The foreign radio stations, including VOA and Radio Liberty, can be very effective, but to do so, they have to grasp and make fundamental to their reporting the psychology of the situation in Russia. That's very hard to do from the outside. So that's an ongoing challenge.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is David Satter, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and author of the new book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Natalia Robert. She's reporter, anchor, and editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Noor Mouati from Tetouan, Morocco. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now a question from Natalia.
In Russia, they do have a number of independent or semi-independent media outlets such as RAIN TV and Echo Moskvy. How do they survive?
Well, there is an audience for truthful information in Russia. As I wrote in the book, I think that the number of aware and conscious people with liberal democratic views is somewhere from 10 to 15% of the population. That's still a fairly large number of people. At the same time, the government itself has an interest in allowing at least some space for truthful information. For one thing, as a safety valve in the society, so that people don't feel that the situation is completely hopeless, in order to create the impression of at least relative democracy for the outside world, and also so that they themselves can get some kind of truthful information about what's going on, and they're not just always talking to themselves. Because the kind of garbage that they produce for the population, if there's no independent media, will be provided back to them as a genuine picture of what's going on. So they themselves lose touch with what's going on in the country. So for all these reasons, they do allow some space for independent journalism, but not, for example, for topics like the apartment bombings. Even the bravest Russian media outlets are not brave enough to deal with that question.
But David Satter, I'll bet they allowed news about Republican nominee Donald Trump's very flattering statements about Vladimir Putin. Well, that leads us to this subject of our U.S. presidential election, where we have Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, basically saying complimentary things about Vladimir Putin, that he would get along great with Vladimir Putin, even though Vladimir Putin has presided over the upending of the post-World War II order by annexing Crimea and destabilizing eastern Ukraine. But it seems like Donald Trump isn't aware of that. He makes muddled statements about Crimea. He didn't seem to know that Crimea was part of Ukraine. He said Putin wasn't in Ukraine. And then when he was corrected, he said, well, the people of Crimea probably rather be under Vladimir Putin's Russia. So again, I mean, how are these kinds of statements, in addition to the ones where he says, with respect to our NATO allies, we'll see about defending them, the Baltic states, they'd have to pay up first. How are these statements being received, on the one hand by the authorities and then by the Russian people?
It's interesting you ask that, because I'm sometimes interviewed by Russian media about what's going on in the U.S. And of course, it's a subject of great interest to them. And Trump is a figure of great interest to them. They do react to what he's saying and are trying to figure out who is this guy. And of course, from a distance of thousands of miles, he's maybe even more puzzling to them than he is to a lot of people in the U.S. But generally speaking, he is popular among Russian people who've been led to believe that the problem in U.S.-Russian relations is the hostile attitude of the Obama administration. And they are taking the view, and it's been inculcated, that if Obama leaves and a new leader comes in who's friendly, then the problems in relations will, if not disappear, at least be reduced. So that's the kind of impression that a lot of people in Russia have gotten, and that's the result of the way the whole thing has been covered largely in the Russian media.
Quick question before I allow Natalia, because you said that there's the perception that there's a hostile attitude on the part of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. But in recent days, with respect to Syria, we see Secretary of State John Kerry constantly trying to garner cooperation with Foreign Minister Lavrov in Syria, when in fact our objectives are very different. And do you see any room for cooperation on Syria, really, given our different objectives?
Well, the Putin regime is not going to be influenced by reasonable gestures on the part of the American administration. They have their own reasons for cultivating hostility and tension between the two countries. The impression of an external enemy unifies the population around the leadership and redirects their aggression toward an external foe. So therefore, Secretary of State Kerry can make concessions until he's blue in the face, and it's not going to change anything. In fact, you know, I was actually testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and I raised this issue with the senators there, that Kerry had made a really interesting remark. He had said that Minister Lavrov lied to my face. And this was an extraordinary remark, because it indicated that Kerry is totally uninformed. My reaction was, what were you expecting him to do? Of course he did. And if you expected anything different, then there's something wrong with you.
David, you mentioned the creation of the external enemy to unify the people around the power of the president and the regime. Is war in Ukraine such a situation, or is it being used by Russia for a small little war in Crimea, seizing of Crimea, and then going into the eastern Ukraine? Is that being used to unify the Russian people around Putin?
Absolutely, and that was the reason for going to war. Ostensibly, it was a war to defend Russian speakers. The Russian speakers in Ukraine do not need any defense. I mean, Kyiv is a Russian-speaking city.
My father is a Russian-speaking Ukrainian. He claims he does not need Putin to protect his rights.
Well, no one did. I mean, there were some tensions there, but nothing serious. In fact, it's interesting that Viktor Yanukovych, his party of the regions, had in its platform respect for the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and that included Crimea. No, this was launched in order to distract the attention of the Russian people from the real lessons of the Euromaidan revolt, that it's possible to spontaneously and peacefully organize against a kleptocratic regime. And if you're facing a regime which monopolizes the levers of power, there are not that many options. One of the options is the Maidan option. And the Russians were absolutely committed to discrediting that option in the eyes of the Russian people by, first of all, destabilizing the successor government to Yanukovych, and second of all, immersing them in a kind of chauvinistic euphoria that would blunt any kind of critical thought.
David, you were banned in December 2013.
Right. I was there in the run-up to the...
I was in the period when it was
completely peaceful.
What did you feel in the air? Did Russian people think that something like Maidan was actually about to happen? And did they believe that the change in Ukraine is coming?
Are we talking about Russian people in Russia?
In Russia, mm-hmm.
Here we get into a problem of timing, because I left Russia just as Maidan was beginning, and then I spent weeks in Ukraine trying to settle various bureaucratic problems with my visa. So I was actually out of Russia physically at the time that Maidan was beginning to gather strength.
But David, the fundamental question is, in the very few minutes we have left, can there ever be a Maidan revolution in the heart of Russia? You know, you talk about the need for the Russian people to face the truth about Russia's experience of post-Soviet democracy before there can be a true awakening. So you may want to discuss that. And in addition, what would it take to really break down this kleptocracy of Putin's Russia? You talk about a moral revolution needs to happen.
Well, and that's one of the ways in which foreign broadcasting can make a difference, actually, by fostering that to a degree. I mean, can't do it by itself. But to get back to your question, of course, a split in the leadership is possible. But given the situation in Russia as it's involved and the domination of corruption at all levels of the society, one set of leaders might prove to be no better than the leaders that exist right now, even if they come to power on a banner of anti-corruption. But if the population organizes itself against kleptocratic rule, and if under those circumstances at least a part of the elite breaks off, I use the word elite very conditionally, and joins the protesters, it is possible that something like what happened in Ukraine could happen in Russia. At that point, it will be very important what is the moral and psychological state of the population and who are engaged in this popular revolt.
But also important, I imagine, are external factors. To what extent could they also tip the balance? We just discussed the U.S. presidential election. If a new president, not Mr. Trump in this case, but let's say if Hillary Clinton became president, do you anticipate a change in U.S. policy vis-a-vis Russia? And how much of a factor would that be in promoting positive change within?
I think the most important factor in promoting positive change in Russia would be moral influence and not policy decisions, which are bureaucratic and limited in their application. As far as moral influence is concerned, neither of the American leading political candidates for president are in any position to exercise it. And this is part of the problem that we have in the country at the moment. The policies under both Clintons were bureaucratic and exceptionally career-driven. Trump's statements, on the other hand, are wildly incompetent. The only thing that one can say, in fairness, is that unlike Hillary Clinton, he has had no sustained exposure to intelligence information, whereas she has a record of either not thinking about it, ignoring it, or not understanding it. It's hard to say. What he would do if he did receive that kind of exposure is something that is not 100% predictable.
Of course, we have to note, too, that his campaign advisor, Paul Manafort, was a supporter, or he worked for the Russian government, and of course many other advisors.
There are corrupt connections, believe me, on both sides. And one of the big donors to the Clinton Foundation is the head of Trans World Group in London, which was deeply connected to the Aluminum Wars, in which maybe dozens, if not hundreds, of people were murdered.
But also Paul Manafort, he was the campaign manager for President Yanukovych, and that seemed not to make any difference for the Republican Party. Why did that happen?
These are corrupt people. I mean, whoever pays.
And
you know, I think I know nothing about Manafort, but my guess is, knowing the milieu, if one of Yanukovych's opponents had paid him the same amount of money, he would have worked for the opponent. But this type of person, and there are a lot of them here, they don't understand the moral implications of what they're doing. It's just a job, and whoever pays. And by the way, we've got plenty of lobbyists and lawyers who think exactly the same way in both parties, believe me.
Indeed. Do you have one more question?
David, you mentioned moral influence. How do we do that? A number of NGOs have been banned. Independent journalists, foreign reporters have been sent out of the country. Population doesn't seem to be interested in different point of view. How do we influence
them? Well, there are
a
couple of things to bear in mind. For one thing, there is now a very large Russian and Ukrainian diaspora. In fact, this has provoked a lot of family fights. But if we speak of the Russian diaspora for the moment, it's very large. It contains many talented people, and these people go back and forth to Russia, and they have contact there. They are an important potential source of truthful information for their fellow countrymen or their fellow nationals, who will be, in many ways, potentially more receptive to what they say than to what we say. But the other thing is that there's an intellectual effort here that needs to be made. We cannot expect to influence people. Foreign broadcasting, which is our most important tool, if foreign broadcasting is highly bureaucratized.
Or even underfunded.
Or underfunded.
Funding won't do it. Some of the Russian media outlets are definitely underfunded, and they do a fantastic job. I think that the funding is fine, and of course it never hurts, but that's not the core of the problem. The core of the problem is being willing to view the truth, imagination on the part of the political leadership, and imagination on the part of in terms of those who work here. I know lots of them and love them all, and they have the imagination if they're given the proper situation. But it does require a kind of deeper approach to the underlying problems, and then basing, in fact, our outreach on that, on ways of addressing them.
And that may be a topic for another show. David Satter is the author of the new book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. David, congratulations again on your book, and thank you so much for coming in and sharing your insights. Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Al Santos. And joining me on the program was Natalia Robert, reporter, anchor, and editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.